mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus, you're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we are angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen. Merry Christmas and welcome back to the Angry History Podcast. And yes, with the Grinch, even in this holiday season, we managed to find some anger with the symbol of Christmas rage, his bad self, the Grinch.
Yes, it's rage burning like the WPIX Channel 11 Yule Log.
I love the Yule Log.
Which they have brought back now. We're both Absolutely. Very happy about that. So we decided we'd climb into the Wayback Machine and hit some Christmas memories throughout the years. First off, you're in the Beltway now, Owen. You've moved a little bit. You're back on a good coast. You're getting ever closer to New York, much like the Santa tracker.
Yes.
You're tracking your travel slowly to New York.
NORAD has given my positioning system out. I'm in Alexandria for Christmas, and I like this town. Old Town is pretty terrific. It's got a great independent comic book store and oodles of history, as you might imagine, and it's pretty awesome. Funny little note, though, about Yule Log. It is such a New York thing, such a quintessential New York thing. And the first Yule Log was actually, I think they shot it in Gracie Mansion, where the mayor of New York City traditionally lives. But years later, they did they updated it slightly, still, I think, right before our time. And they did that out in Pasadena, California. So sorry to pull the curtain back too much on that.
Yeah, they managed to find a fireplace, I believe, that was very similar to the original one. And that's why they went out to California and did it. Our first stop is going to be in Christmas 1966, which is the Grinch. You just heard him. And I just want to say I always rooted for him. I'm always a little sad at the end when he caves. I mean, there's that split second when he gets caught in the chimney. And I said the other day, it scares me every time because I want to scream, no, he's going to die in there like Phoebe Cates' father in Gremlins.
I forgot all about that.
Yeah. I told someone that they just stared at me. Oh, my. I would not have known that I remembered that. And yet there it was. It always scares me a little. And he didn't sound like a bad guy. I mean, no. He has garlic in his soul. I always figure
Mike's
like
soul. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And of course, the pedigree of the whole entire show, Dr. Seuss wrote it. The Grinch himself is Boris Karloff, who is Frankenstein's monster, among many other things, and was directed by Mr. Looney Tunes himself, Chuck Jones.
Yeah.
Pretty fantastic.
And Thurl Ravenscroft, which sounds like he could be a Dr. Seuss character on his own right.
Or an internet-generated name.
You know? That's really true. He should be fighting in Middle-earth somewhere. But he was also the voice of Tony the Tiger when we were kids, as you could sort of
That's
maybe
right.
hear in your mind when you listen to it.
They're great.
Yeah. And he received no credit for it. He had fought in World War II, as many of these people have that we talk about over time from that era. He got no screen credit, and Dr. Seuss decided he would try to fix it. He sent a letter to every major columnist in America identifying him as the performer.
That's pretty awesome. And Dr. Seuss was not really interested in adapting this, right, initially?
No, he didn't want to. It was Chuck Jones who talked him into it, and of course now it's a classic, but he didn't want to see his stuff moving. I guess it's like a lot of artists. They just don't really want to see their stuff.
Chuck Jones could talk me into anything. How many sugars would you like? Oh, three or four. but it's funny, if you think about that, the adaptations of Seuss's work have been sort of wildly uneven at best. I think probably the best, this is one of the absolute best, and I'd say the other great one is Cat in the Hat from 71, where Alan Sherman, Hello Mudda, Hello Fodder, was the voice of the cat. And then you look at the Mike Myers movie of Cat in the Hat and the Jim Carrey Grinch movie, on the other end of the spectrum of quality.
Yeah, it doesn't really go as live action so much. Kids work, but I don't think that giant man dressed as a cat or a Grinch is kind of creepy to
me. It's somewhat terrifying, bring these things into life.
Fun for people to put politicians on there, though. That's about the only thing those posters are good for around here.
Yep.
It came with our packages, boxes, or bags. He puzzled and puzzled till his puzzle of a saw. Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more.
Today, the press, or I guess really more accurately, opinion media, has has manufactured a so-called war on Christmas, and it's sort of a chance for a lot of people in that type of television to get on their hind legs and really try to continue to drive wedges between all of us. That being said, there's always been a sensitivity about broadcasting religious messages on television, and the Charlie Brown Christmas special is kind of a watershed for that. It's our oldest, well, second oldest, right? What's Rudolph?
Yeah, second oldest, yep. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, it was oldest, just beat it by a year. This is Christmas 1965.
Wow. But it had a very overt, there was no happy holiday, there was no, this was the Charlie Brown Christmas special talking about Christmas. Charlie is bent out of shape about the commercialism. Charlie pleads, like, you know, what is this, what is Christmas all about? Can someone really help me out here? And leave it to Linus, who reads from the Bible. And this did not go over well in the planning and production of the show initially, right?
No, they actually told them at CBS they were horrified, if you read IMDb, horrified at the idea of an animated Christmas special with such a blatant message. Producer-director Bill Menendez told Charles Schulz, look, you can't read from the Bible on network television. I mean, today, I said press, but it's, you know, the opinion media, so much of it is that now. And especially this time of year, you know, they say news is made. It's actually made like a product, like sausage. And, you know, this time of year, there's not many people writing columns. There's not, you have kind of the third string people in the newsroom who either have no family or couldn't get off for seniority in the newsroom. And so there's
that was
not
me.
Much.
I worked 10 Christmases in a row.
Oh, yeah, gosh. But they told them all these things. You know, they were so afraid. The producer and director we just mentioned, Mr. Melendez, and the executive producer, Lee Mendelson, they were sure it would fail. And then the reviews start coming in. And it turns out an astonishing 50% of all television sets in the country were tuned in to watch this Christmas special.
Right.
It's just a staggering number. That kind of thing just cannot happen anymore with the numbers.
No. It's funny. I watched it the other day for the first time in quite a while, start to finish. And man, is it still a sweet, sweet special. It's really quite something.
Yeah. And it broke some other rules of television, too. There's no laugh track on it, which they usually did. And again, the executives there at the network said, you have to have a laugh track because, you know, kids don't know when to laugh. Otherwise, and they used real children to voice the characters instead of adults, as they usually did, as we just talked about with the Grinch and those kind of shows. That also adds to that sort of halting Peanuts speech pattern that we became familiar with now, because the kids often were so young that they didn't know what the words they were speaking meant, especially Sally. Mm-hmm. And that's why they sort of have that halting speech pattern. Then they would cut everything together later.
Yep. And it really, that children's speech thing is such a great trademark of these Charlie Brown shows, and it works so well, particularly here.
Yeah, it was good. And Schulz wanted to tell the story. Again, you know, this was different from what his usual drawing cartoons was, but he was a Lutheran at the time. He was pretty devout, and he said, if we don't do it, who will? And, you know, it just became something really nice, and obviously it's part of Christmas of this day, and the fears were unwarranted. And it turned out to be a really great song. And we will listen to Linus here, his speech. And we really still feel moved by it. And there's one little part of it that always gets me is when Linus reads the speech, which is from Luke 2:10, he recites the words, fear not. And when he says that, he drops his security blanket.
Which is great symbolism because he held on to that.
Yep.
Over his childhood anxieties and fears.
Yeah. And it's just a little something that they put in there, you know.
It's very nice. I hadn't noticed that, Dean. Very cool. All right. So let's give a listen.
Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
Sure, Charlie Brown. I can tell you what Christmas is all about. Lights, please. And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them. And the glory of the Lord shone round about them. And they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, fear not. For behold, I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. You shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God, and saying, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
It's one of my favorite Linus voices, too, throughout the years. But
yeah, that was Christopher Dylan Shea. He passed away at just 52 years old in 2010.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he's a legend.
He is. Now, this one is great. This is something a little bit closer to our era. And it's funny, you know, the backstory for this is Silver Bells, okay? And it's Steve Martin and Paul Simon, whose voices you'll recognize, and it's Billy Joel on the piano. And I never knew it was Billy Joel. The way I'd heard this story, this has been a Christmas favorite for years, and it's a great bootleg. A buddy of mine, Jay, turned me on to it years and years ago. And the way I'd heard the story, it was Saturday Night Live always has a full dress run through before they do a show. And sometimes things get dropped for one reason or another, a sketch here or there. And I always heard that this was a sketch that they dropped because it was too racy. And it's actually nice to get the real story here. But let's hear it first, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it. Give a listen.
I think at the end, you should join us with, if you can, if it falls that way.
I don't want to screw it up.
Silver bell.
I think.
Yeah. Here we go.
One, two. City sidewalks, busy sidewalks, dressed in holiday style. In the air, there's the feeling of Christmas. People passing, children laughing, and for mile after mile, on every street corner, you'll hear silver bells, silver bells. It's Christmas time in the city.
Last night, my child looked up at me and said, Uncle Steve, he didn't know I was his father. And I didn't know for sure either. I just assumed I was. I'd had his mother so many times and in so many different ways. The odds were with me. Anyway, he looked up at me and said, what does Christmas mean to you? And I said, Lemuel, Christmas is a time for giving, a time for receiving, a time for eggnog and rum, a time for cutting down trees and hanging plastic doodads on them and watching them die slowly in your living room, catch fire and burn down your house and all your possessions. It's a time for buying things that haven't sold all year long, wrapping them up in shiny paper, and giving them to your friends, return them and find out you got it on sale. They can only exchange them for things of equal value, like charcoal briquettes or matchbooks with other people's names on them. A time for giving your wife that special coat she always wanted. Those seals didn't need their fur anyway. What do they want it for? They're dead already. It's a time for eggnog and brandy, driving home on icy streets, accidentally nudging the car next to you off the bridge into the frozen river, watching the car sink, seeing the bubbles float up under the water. It's time to sip an eggnog martini and think about the poor and talk of feeding the naked and clothing the hungry. A time to get Christmas cards from all your friends that consolidated and allied an acme. A time for seeing all those happy children sitting on Santa's lap in Toyland, thinking to yourself, maybe I'll be a Santa next year. 12 years old is not so far from 18. Maybe I should be laying a little groundwork for the future. It's a time for parties at the office with eggnog and vodka. Telling your boss what you really think of him while he gets a perfect Xerox of your wife's rear end. Time for sitting by the hearth, sipping eggnog and tequila, with your feet up on a burning log, realizing that Uncle Walt has been in your garage for 45 minutes with the car running. You say to yourself, damn, Uncle Walt, you were supposed to bring me back more eggnog. And that, Lemuel, is what Christmas means to me.
Soon it will be Christmas Day.
Now, Dean, you tracked all this down that Billy Joel talked about here, and he shed light on really what can only be called a Christmas gift that keeps on giving in a 2001 interview with American Airlines in-flight magazine American Way. One night around Christmas 20 years ago, the piano man said, to sort of date this to Christmas, late 70s, early 80s, quote, I was doing a recording session at A&R Studios in Hell's Kitchen, that's in New York. We just finished the session, and my producer and I decided to get some food. It was fairly late at night, and we ran into Paul Simon and Steve Martin at the restaurant. We had a little bit of wine, bottle of, and then we had a little more wine. Nobody was feeling any pain. We got a brainstorm that we could go back to the studio and record a Christmas record. It must have been about midnight at this point.
I have to stop you in the middle of this because when I was reading this story,
yes, Lemuel,
again, our our research knows no bounds.
No, it's true.
Yeah, to go all the way to American Airlines in-flight magazine is pretty awesome.
Pretty awesome.
But I'm willing to bet the restaurant they were in is a place that was called Guido's. Okay. It was this great old family place. I don't know that you were ever there. I've been there many times back when it was open. But I don't know if you ever came with our group.
No, we went to that Greek place over in Hell's Kitchen a couple of times, but I don't remember that Guido's. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, it was on 9th Avenue, just south of the Port Authority bus terminal.
Right.
And it was known just by word of mouth. They never advertised. It was very big with the musical community, cash only business. If you drove by, you wouldn't even know it was a restaurant. It just said Supreme Macaroni Company outside. And in the front was a pasta shop that had been an old butcher shop. And if you went in there to the back through the curtains, you'd find the family, all these family photos on the wall. They had their own homemade wine. And it's actually the back cover of the Stranger album of Billy Joel. If you still have the album somewhere in your attic, you want to look it up online.
You know, the album that your grandparents used to roll joints on, you know.
Yeah, it was taken right in there. And so I said to myself, gosh, that must be it. And it seems like every week we're eulogizing a great old New York place.
But I know. You shocked me on that on Kennedy's on the Park Slope episode that was closed. It's like, I've got to get back to New York before there's nothing left.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Well, without your tab, these places are closing down. You know,
it's true. I do what I can. I try.
Yeah. So I'm sorry I interrupted you. Why don't you pick up Billy Joel's quote there about this?
Absolutely. So back to Billy. Quote, so we go back to the studio and Paul Simon and I are singing in the background that Christmas carol, Silver Bells. We're harmonizing and Steve Martin starts into this soliloquy, what Christmas means to me, with these hysterical descriptions of the secretary sitting on the copying machine, all these very risque scenarios. And Paul and I are just trying to keep it together. We did this maybe in one take and we had a Christmas single. Now it was never given to a record company, but there's a copy of it floating around somewhere. Stuff like that happens in New York. It's a small town, end quote. And it really is one of my favorite things. And this song itself, especially when I put it through the SNL lens, it always sort of reminds me of New York and Christmas in the city. And something else. Do you remember this, Dean? Remember 976-3636? You would dial Santa Claus?
North Pole, Santa Claus speaking.
Call Santa at home. Dial 1-976-8888. It costs 69 cents per minute.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I was walking down the street just before we did this, doing a little bit last-minute shopping, and it came to me, and I hadn't thought about it in 20 years at least. It had to have been. We were still in East Flatbush when you used to be able to call this number, and that was, you know, we left there in 82. So, of course, wouldn't take long until you'd call 976-3636, and it would be something else altogether. But for a while there, it was really exciting stuff that it would sort of update you where Santa was and how, you know, was doing. So. But anyway, that was cool.
That is a blast from the past. Yeah. And this shows how much things have changed. Billy Joel's giving this interview just talking about his New York Christmases. And they didn't think to prompt him to ask him about this tape out there, but it was just music that was out there.
Yeah.
And now these are the great things you can find on the internet. Sometimes I think that's all it's good for, is finding this great old
Absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, as soon as I found it on, and this was like back in the early days of YouTube and rudimentally trying to rip it so you can, you know, put it into your MP3 collection. And yeah, it's in there now, but it's such a great tune to have. So.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I love you, Lord Jesus, go down from the skies and stay by my bed until morning is.
speaking of that small town feeling in New York City, you're listening to Our Sisters of Life in the background. They're up on West 51st Street in Manhattan. This is just now from Christmas 2013. My wife and I were headed over to the Irish Arts Center, and we heard them out there singing some old-time Christmas carols. Yeah. And I have to tell you, Owen, that at the Irish Arts Center, I picked you up a little gift. When you reach New York City, you're gonna get to see that.
Well, hopefully we can do – I got you a little something, too. Hopefully we can do it at McSorley's like God intended.
It would be very appropriate.
It would be. It would be. And I was thinking, listening to this before, so nice that you captured this, you know. And it's so nice that you could even just put your iPhone up there and boom, there it is, you know. Very, very sweet. Very nice to hear. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I hear Kathy underneath there a little bit. Was she
singing? She did. She's a singer as well as a trained musician. And so she pitched right in. The sisters were handing out cocoa and cookies.
That's great.
And it was a nice scene. And there's a little bit of history there when we looked it up. The man who became John Cardinal O'Connor of New York founded the order after he visited Dachau concentration camp.
Wow.
And he was a bishop-elect at the time. He placed his hands inside the red brick crematoria, and he said he, quote, felt the intermingled ashes of Jew and Christian, rabbi, priest, and minister. And it inspired him to start this order to respect all human life.
Well, that works for me. Let's move on to another interesting clip, too. And, of course, you know, we go back when we can. This is a World War II clip. Brings us to remembering all of our fighting men and women who are away from home now, this time of year, serving in an incredible 150 countries around the world. And they're still in Afghanistan, fighting and dying, though media largely seems more concerned with what color Santa is or isn't than an actual war going on. And if you think that America or you know the public or media has war fatigue, consider the servicemen and women and their families. That's war fatigue.
And that may be a very rare thing at Christmas at home if they're lucky enough to even get back home.
And I thank them as an American and as a citizen of the world, too, on top of that. I thank you for what you do. And gosh, you do it. I'm a civilian. I look at you guys in awe and wonder, you know. Thank you. But here's a clip. This is from BBC legend Godfrey Talbot, and he made his name spending time with the Desert Rats facing off against Rommel in North Africa. This is Mr. Talbot with the 8th Army in Tripoli, Libya. Let's go back to Christmas 1942. That
carol came from some of the men of the 8th Army, and it was sung from the borders of Tripolitania. We are here, we just pulled off the coast road that goes along there towards Sirte and ultimately to Tripoli, and over by our recording trucks have come one or two men of the 8th Army, and they're led by a corporal. I can see him there in his great coat and tin hat playing a clarinet, as you've just heard, and they've just been having a bit of a sing-song. And we've recorded this bit of it. As a matter of fact, they've been singing all kinds of songs. There's a bit of a difficulty in getting them to sing a carol at all, to be quite honest. And I don't want you to get the impression that the 8th Army is just having a nice picnic and is going gaily singing carols up the cut road after Rommel. They're not at all. They're far too busy fighting this war, and a grim enough business it is, and all this sand and dreary desert, and there's very little time for singing at all. We are a good way at the moment behind our forward troop. We certainly won't be going about caroling tonight. And Christmas, all those will be remembered and celebrated in the desert, won't, to be quite honest, be an affair of plum puddings and merry crackers and parties and good feasting for the men of the 8th Army.
Didn't they really sound so excited to be singing that?
Yeah, and I liked how he said there, too. Don't get the idea they're sitting around here having to sing along. I mean, these guys had faced death and would be facing it again. Godfrey Talbot was there to tell their story. This really, you know, he wasn't out to make a name for himself, but he did, especially since these all had to be edited by four separate censors, Army, Navy, RAF, and the Egyptian government. So the fact that he managed to get anything home at all beyond, hello, we're here.
Was
pretty impressive. He passed away in 2000 at age 91.
Good stuff. Well, thank you for that, Mr. Talbot. We also have time to roll a clip from some of our space heroes, the real ones, not the ones whom we usually reference, that boy from Iowa. But anyway, this is namely the astronauts of Apollo 8, the first humans to orbit the moon. And on Christmas Eve, 1968, 45 years ago today from this recording, in what was the most watched television event in your Earth's history, Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and Frank Borman took turns reading from the Book of Genesis as they orbited the moon. Check this out.
I hope that all of you back on Earth can see what we mean when we say it's a rather foreboding horizon, a rather dark and unappetizing looking place. We're now going over our order to make it easy for the initial landing attempt, in order to preclude having to dodge mountains. Now you can see the long shadows of the lunar sunrise. We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. God divided the light from the darkness.
And God called the light day. And the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day.
And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you. All of you on the good earth.
Now, as we were saying, today there's a lot of talk about this. They decided to name this war the War on Christmas. But at the time, it may shock you, back in what people always think was somehow a good and better time, there was an atheist, Madeline Murray O'Hare, and she sued the government over this, alleging First Amendment violations, and went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in, I like to think, a real moment of dry sarcasm, cited lack of jurisdiction. They decided they did not extend to the moon. They couldn't declare one way or the other. Yeah. But they clearly didn't want to offend anybody. Captain Jim Lovell reenacted it this year at the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry. And he said some really nice stuff about the idea here was to bring people together, not separate people. He said, quote, it's a foundation of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. It is the foundation of most of the world's religion. They all had a basis in the Old Testament. So he was just trying, they were just trying to say something appropriate. It was a reporter's wife, actually, who recommended that they do this. And it was a nice little moment there. How could you not be in awe? You're circling the moon for,
That's it. You know, you always hear, you know, there are no atheists in the foxhole. And I would imagine something similar would have to kind of be in play in outer space.
Yeah.
You know? Not even outer space. I mean, we're barely cut the cord from our home planet. But to be that high up, gosh, can you imagine?
Yeah, what else are you going to read? You have to read some grand, sweeping prose. And this is a thing. Back then, people of all stripes, like I've said before, Johann Most, you couldn't get much more anarchist and atheist than him. But he could quote it. And if you were a charlatan pastor out there, he'd be doing the job of for actual believers by quoting back to him. And he could crush the guy because that was just great prose to them, even if they weren't moved by the divinity of anything, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny about this too, and talking about religion and the space program and the men who went on the lunar surface. Buzz Aldrin, who you remember, he was second on the surface after Neil Armstrong, and he read from the scripture off air, but he received communion on the lunar surface. I'm not quite sure how he pulled that off, which is pretty impressive. But you've got to be careful with anything with Buzz Aldrin. Like, there's a guy who told him that he never landed on the moon to his face, and we have great video from back in the old days, and Buzz just lays one right in the guy's chin. You know, okay, so go ahead, tell him there's no God either, see what happens.
Yeah, that's really is true. I never thought of the threat. And these guys, how can you not be in awe of them? It's hard to relate to today, just the idea of how big a deal it is to circle the moon. This was incredible. I mean, there's that great old Onion cover, holy F. It's like the moon. I'm on the freaking moon. It's, it's crazy. And it was, that's something we dreamt about for millennia. And I guess it's too bad we missed out on that. What a joy of triumph that must have been.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's one more clip we have to play. This one from The Cosby Show. It's Dr. Cliff Huxtable is playing the scene with Olivia, the little girl there played by Raymond Simone. And if you've been paying attention to one of the many opinion media on opinion media stories that Owen was talking about lately, you know why this clip came to mind just recently. This is from Christmas 1989, height of the big sweater craze.
Have you ever seen the real Santa?
Of course I have. Every year he comes down the chimney in my house and he says, Dr. Huxtable, how are you? Ho, ho, ho.
What does he look like?
He's got rosy cheeks, beard, and a twinkle in his eye.
Is he Caucasian or African American or Asian?
Santa Claus is whatever you are in that house. See, when he comes down the chimney, let's say that you were Japanese, he would zoom Japanese. See, and then he would come in here, same Santa Claus, zoom African American. I was over to Mr. Jefferson's house. He's Caucasian, you know. And I'm sitting there, Mr. Jefferson left. Santa Claus came down, zoom! He was Caucasian. Looked at me, he said, uh-oh. You understand? So I said, it's all right, he'll be downstairs in a minute. And we gave a high five.
You're making no sense, Dr. Huxtable. No one can change like that.
Are you telling me that Santa Claus, the man who makes toys for little kids, the man who knows if you're naughty or nice, doesn't have the ability to change?
What color is he at the North Pole?
You have to ask Mrs. Santa Claus.
Is there anybody better than Cliff Huxtable?
Nope. Nope.
I mean, and I like how he has a little bit of the Fat Albert in there.
Hey,
I mean,
the guys, ho, ho, ho.
Yeah. Such a performer. Like, he just had. And by the way, they lived in New York, too. So, yep. You know, I mean, why would you want to be anywhere?
Exactly. I remember when I was a kid, I went to visit my godmother, who at the time was living in Kansas City, Missouri. And she was running a hospital out there. And I went to visit her. And then she took me to some kids' museum. I was 8. And they had all these sort of handprints with some people that they got to do it, kind of like at the Chinese theater in Hollywood. But they had one from Bill Cosby. And you put your hand in it. And there was 6 fingers on it, and he did it as a joke. He's like, I don't know.
Wow.
Or maybe he has 6 fingers. I don't know. But
yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's why he did Leonard Part 6.
Oh, that's not a nice Christmas gift. But again, what I love what he does with this bit, though, I would love any of these shows who had wasted so much time over the past couple of weeks going back and forth about the Santa Claus nonsense. Like, just play that clip. Before we moved to Fort Greene, I lived in East Flatbush, and it was by the time we were there, it was fairly mixed. But you would see as many black Santas on the door as you would white. You know, it's like you said, whatever he is inside your house. And, you know, if you can't deal with that, then I don't know, you could get a hobby.
But we know anyway that Santa Claus is not black or white. He's Greek.
That's,
I mean,
right.
Saint Nicholas? Come on. How many Nicholases do you know that are Greek? But yeah, this is sort of along those same lines we talked about earlier, as far as, you know, when there's a column written, in this case there was a column written called Santa Claus Should Not Be a White Man Anymore, and you know, most people would ignore it in the press, but when there's not much out there to be done, somebody will decide, well, that's a good segment, we got to do that, because he's I don't know, right. I don't want to have a spoiler,
we're bereft of anything that's really yeah. good, that has any traction, yeah. is meaningful to anybody beyond, you know, getting at the most knee-jerk of rage reactions.
And just between you and me, Owen, I mean, if there are any children listening, you know, please cover their ears. Santa Claus isn't real. He's not anything. It's all a scam that people make up for their kids. It's fake.
How dare you, sir?
I know. All right. You can bring the kids back now. Let the earmuffs off.
Okay.
Well, that wraps up our Christmas extra. We'll leave you with a song from Christmas 1973. It's performed by Teddy Van with an assist from his then 5-year-old daughter, Akeem. This song may give you a chuckle about the discussion that we were just talking about as far as Santa Claus goes and what he looks like under all that outfit.
Yeah, I love this song. It's like Gil Scott Heron's Christmas song, you know, if you had one. This has been a great year for us with Angry History. We've taken this show from an idea born at a table in McSorley's, and now, you know, we've got a whole duffel bag full of them that you guys have been listening to and enjoying. I say thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for us. Merry Christmas. The best of luck to everyone in 2014. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
We'll see you back here in 2014. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas. And enjoy this song. It's a Teddy Van, a take on I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, you want to hear the vendetta to sight? You know what I found you last night. Just when Mama turned out the light.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com. Santa Claus is a black man.